Hi, I'm Baz Eidowin, the cinematographer on The Mandalorian, and you're listening to The Go Creative Show.
Hey everyone, my name is Ben Consoli. I am a director and owner of BC Media Productions. And this is The Go Creative Show, the show dedicated to creative professionals and filmmakers. Today we discuss the making of The Mandalorian with cinematographer Baz Eidowin. Learn how Baz used innovative LED panel technology for backgrounds and his thoughts on the phenomenon that is Baby Yoda. The Go Creative Show is supported by Post Lab, Shutterstock, Rule Boston Camera, and Premium Beat. Now, when I sat down and started watching The Mandalorian, I thought to myself, yeah, I'm just going to watch a couple episodes, you know? No, I ended up getting completely whipped into a frenzy and wrapped up into the whole story. I watched the whole thing and I loved it. And I'm not even like a giant Star Wars fan, but I loved The Mandalorian. I could not stop watching it for a couple of reasons. One, cinematography was absolutely gorgeous, and we're going to talk a lot about that today. But it's just a great story. It's fun to watch, great action sequences. And I just love the world that was created by Baz Eidowin and the entire team there at The Mandalorian. Now, of course, we got Baz Eidowin on the show today to talk about his work. He was the director of photography for the show. He was also the second unit director of photography with Greg Frazier as the main DP for Rogue One. And we talk a lot about that as well. But what's so cool about The Mandalorian is they had some really innovative and unique ways of filming this. There are a lot of scenes that don't even have green screen. They're actually shooting inside a giant studio with huge LED panels that are projecting the sets right there on the panels. And then they bring the talent in front and they shoot it as if they're just in those rooms. It's really like next level cinematography stuff. And Baz does a great job of explaining how he did it. You know, his lens choices, his lighting choices, camera choices, why he made those choices, and all about this LED kind of panel universe that he's shooting in. So this episode is jam-packed with information that all cinematography enthusiasts are going to enjoy, whether you saw The Mandalorian or not. It doesn't matter. This information is for anybody that just loves filmmaking and learning about how film and TV shows are made. And that's what we're all about here at Go Creative Show. You're also going to notice that we have a lot of audience questions in this episode. And if you want your question heard on the show, follow us on social media, Instagram, Facebook, Twitter. We ask, we'll let you know when we have upcoming guests and then give you an opportunity to ask a question, which we then ask on the show with a little shout out to you and your profile. So it's a great opportunity to become part of the Go Creative Show. And we love that. So follow us on all of our social media channels. And of course, subscribe to the show so you never miss an episode. All right. So much interview to get to. I cannot wait to share this one with you guys. The director of photography for The Mandalorian, Baz Eidowin. So I'm here with Baz Eidowin, the director of photography, one of the directors of photography for The Mandalorian. Baz, thank you so much for being on the show.
It's my pleasure. Thanks for inviting me.
Now, right away, I'm saying one of, because there were two on this show, and the previous DP, or the other DP that you're working with, was also a guest on Go Creative Show. So I'd like to kind of start there and talk about how the two of you got together and how you worked together on this show.
Yes, Greg Frazier.
Yeah.
I'm extraordinarily lucky in that he and I got on very well when we were first introduced to each other about 6 or 7 years ago. And we developed a good, strong working relationship. I was his assistant DP or co-DP or additional photography DP or second unit DP on a number of projects. That culminated in The Mandalorian, where he knew he couldn't shoot the whole project, but he wanted somebody to be his co-DP that would shoot it in a style or manner that was reflective of his choices, creative choices. Mm-hmm. And so he basically prepped for 5 months. I prepped for 3. He shot for about a month and I shot for the next 5 months.
Wow. Wow. Now, you guys worked together on Rogue One, which is where Greg was first on this show to talk about his experience doing that. And Lion was what he was promoting at the time too.
Right.
So you were involved in Rogue One with him, but what was your role in Rogue One?
I was a second unit DP.
Okay. And so making that jump from second unit DP to DP, that I think is like, that's a dream for a lot of people. We did a whole episode about second unit and what it means and, you know, what the relationship is with the director of photography. And that jump is, that's a highly coveted position. That must have been an amazing experience for you.
Yes, very, very much so. I was very, the jump, I was very happy to make the jump. I have been in the business for a very long time. I've done the hard yards. I've done a lot of additional photography for a lot of fantastic DPs and directors over the years, and always wanted to be the main DP, to shoot myself. So Greg really gave me the chance to do that on The Mandalorian by getting it going and then handing over the reins, and he went off to shoot Dune while I shot the rest of the season.
What is it about second unit, or is there something about second unit that makes you a better, I don't even know what to call it, first unit, primary DP, I don't even know what the distinction is in the titles, but is there something about an experience in second unit that helps you when you are the main DP?
Well, it's experience. It's getting the hours under the belt of working on set. You have to make creative choices at every minute of the day. And if they're valid creative choices, then you shoot successful images or sequences. But as a second unit DP, you have to keep all of those creative choices in line with what the main unit DP and director want the show to look like, the film to look like. You don't have the leash is not totally off in that you can't totally make up whatever you want for each scene. You have to follow you need to be following a creative guideline. That's the second unit DP mantra to some extent.
So you may not have as much flexibility, but you're still responsible for a ton.
Oh, extraordinarily so. Yes, you have the same amount of work to do as the main unit DP, but perhaps those initial creative choices that were made with the director and the DP in the nascent stages of production or pre-production of determining the style of the film, you're not necessarily involved in that because that's the main unit DP's purview, is that it's their job to find a style for the appropriate style for the project.
There's something, and I may be digging too deep into this, which I often do, as our listeners know, but I kind of feel like second unit a lot of times is doing landscapes. They're doing a ton of exteriors. They don't necessarily have the main stars in the shot, but they're grabbing all of that textural stuff. And I feel like Mandalorian especially, it lives so much in these wide landscape shots. Like there's such an appreciation for the environments in this. And as I'm watching it and I learned that you were second unit on Rogue One, I'm kind of like, there must have been something there in the training that second unit does that makes you so in tune with the value of really well-executed landscapes and wide shots. I mean, am I digging too deep into this, or do you think there's something there?
No, I think you're actually skipping along the surface. You're not going too deep at all. Second unit is you can do a lot of exterior work in that respect. There's a whole range of second unit work that you could do. On Vice, Adam McKay and Greg wanted me to explore the intimate lives of all of the characters. So for every scene that we would shoot, I would go into the set and then do these just whatever range of shots that I wanted that were character explorations. And these were not landscapes. These were intimate, small shots of portraits on the wall or photographs or people's belongings and stuff like that. Whereas when I did second unit on Sniper, American Sniper, I mean, basically there was a lot of work that we did that was all big, huge action stuff that wasn't necessarily landscapes and it wasn't small, intimate work. It was you know, intense drama. So the range of second unit work that one can do is extraordinarily diverse, really is. The thing that I learned, because I shot second unit for Paul Thomas Anderson as well on The Master, and or additional photography for Paul. And the the thing that second unit photography gave to me, I had the ability to do, to learn from, was that actually every shot needs to advance the story. That's the storytelling is the most important thing, whether it's landscapes or not. And the thing with Star Wars that I learned on Rogue One, or that I knew inherently, and that we discussed in great depth for Mandalorian, is that there needs to be a sense of epic scale. Star Wars is a combination of epic scale and intense human drama. So, or alien drama, depending upon the creature. Yeah. So combining the, finding the ability to combine the sense of epic scale with intense human drama, which I thought we did quite successfully on Rogue One, and on Mandalorian, obviously. So Mandalorian was one of our guidelines was to follow the photographic style, obviously, because Greg and I had worked on Rogue One. But that Rogue One was one of our visual guides.
Alan Alameda on Facebook wants to know what the pressure is like working on a Star Wars universe film. I imagine there's got to be something, because the audience is so rabid and so demanding and critical, you know? What does it feel like from your perspective?
I wouldn't say the Star Wars fan base is rabid. I'd say that they're particularly involved and have a very keen sense of what is right and wrong. It's such a deep galaxy that people can dive into it as hard and long as they want. And so, yeah, the fan base is very involved.
Yeah.
And because of the length of the time that the Star Wars story has been told, and the number of formats, whether it's features or animation, and the books, whether it's canon or not, there is a lot of pressure, because it's a great story and we want to do it right. Mm.
Let's get into the look of the film, of the series. It's absolutely gorgeous. The work that you guys did, you and Greg, it really is, it's just so fun to watch. And it's like the pace is great and it just gives you an opportunity to enjoy the cinematography. Sort of the way that like Breaking Bad was for me, where some of the shots just lingered for a while. You can really absorb the environment. I absolutely loved it. And Brian Walsh on Facebook wants to know how much was shot on location versus green screen. And I do too, because I've been hearing that there's a lot more done practically than one may assume. Can you talk to us about it?
Yes. So we shot on practical sets, on studios, on stages. We had a backlot, a small backlot that essentially was a blue screen environment where they would build large exteriors, small streets, village streets, exterior villages, the village from episode 4 on Sorgan, the street in Navarro, where the planet where Greef Karga is, sandy planets, the Arvala planet, parts of Tatooine, that was for all of the exterior work. But then we had an interior stage, a large stage that had the LED volume in it. Have you heard of that?
Talk to us about that, because that is particularly interesting to me, how this is kind of the new way of, not necessarily green screen replacement, but it's an addition to it, and it provides a new way of shooting this type of stuff. I'd love to hear about it.
The LED volume is a large circular room or space, around about 75 foot in diameter, circle, almost a complete circle, with a ceiling at around about 20 feet tall, and that's all LED panels, a very tight pitch LED panels, so that if you've got the correct focal math on the lens, and you're not focused on the lens, but on the wall, but you're focused on the characters in the foreground, you don't see the moiré or the pixels on the screen. So it's an immersive environment with 3D tracking of images on the back. It's basically a modern version of a rear screen projection. It's a dynamic real-time photoreal background that's played on a massive LED wall. And by tracking the camera, we get parallax and perspective. Mm. So it's a massively complicated, incredibly complicated technical setup to track the camera and to display this live image on the ground. But what it means is that we can be in Iceland in the morning and on a beach in Hawaii in the afternoon.
Mm. And what is it called?
Doesn't really have a name. We call it the volume. It's a
LED volume.
It's an LED wall, and we call it a volume because a volume was the traditional name for a stage space where motion capture was taken out. So we're this is not motion capture because we're photographing live. It's a live combination. It's a combination of live foreground with this dynamic photoreal background that's on the screen. So it's like live green screen or live rear projection basically would be the best comparison. But rear projection was only usable from one spot, one nodal spot, because everything else would have the wrong parallax or wrong perspective. So if we have a dynamically adjustable background, we can move the camera and the background tracks with the camera. So therefore we have a live tracked background that we can photograph.
That's amazing. So what were your tracking points? Did you have tracking points on the screen?
No, there's a large number of motion capture cameras all around, but most of them are along the edge between the ceiling and the wall, and they were tracking a crown that was mounted on the camera that had, I can't remember, 5 or 6 IR infrared tracking nodes. And so whatever the camera did went up or down or tilted forward, up and down, or tracked left and right, as well as knowing what the lens information was, because it was live lens information tracking. The image could be photographed on the wall because it was totally in relation to what was coming from the camera.
So the image that's on that LED panel, that's not being replaced. I'm saying it like I know what I'm talking. I'm asking that as a question. Is it being replaced and it's just there for reference, or is what you're seeing on the LED panel the finished image?
The main goal was to have in-camera finals. So that means doing a – so to get to this point, I need to really back up. What we need to do is in the art department, Andrew Jones, the production designer, would create these virtual environments that were either based upon photogrammetry, which we found to be very successful, or completely CG environments. And so Andrew Jones and his virtual art department would work with ILM's virtual art department, and they would create these environments that we could then put through all of ILM's process to for us to be able to photograph inside the volume. So we would have to create these environments. We would have to then light these environments. We would have to work out how we were going to shoot those environments.
Okay, so were they practical environments, or were they digital environments that you just helped manipulate the lighting in?
It would depend upon what the location was.
Okay.
So if it was a village or if it was something that required a lot of CG creation, in no matter what the environment was, whether it was the black sandy desert of Navarro or the mud planet of Arvala with the Trend Oceans attacking Mando at the beginning of episode 2, or the village in episode 4, or the best one to describe is actually the hangar, what we call the roost hangar for episode 6. So the roost hangar was a space that might have been around about 300 feet, 280 feet long. In a virtual sense, this is how big. It was about 280 feet long, and it was about 70 feet, 60 feet wide. So, and the Razor Crest comes in at the beginning of the episode and flies in through the force barrier and lands inside this aircraft hangar deck, basically.
Okay.
So we had three volumes that for that whole length of that virtual set. So when Mando got out of the ship and then started walking towards the back of the hangar, we first walked through the first load or volume, and then we shot whatever we needed to do in that first volume, and then we would change the volume on the wall, change the load on the volume wall to be the second load, not in a continuous sense. These had to play in cuts, obviously. And then we would walk through the second one, and then when we got to the third one, that was a third volume within that same volumetric area, that CG volumetric area. Whether it was an exterior set where I could move the sun around and put the sun wherever I wanted, or it was an interior set where I could build lights and put lights wherever they would be in a digital sense. Greg and I would light all of these environments, and then ILM would basically create them to the level of computing complexity that they needed to be, and then they would come back and we would run them through all the computers to put them up on the wall and the volume.
That's amazing. So I want to make sure I'm understanding it right. So the production designer would work with ILM. They'd create the sets, and then you guys would go in and light the sets virtually with ILM. And then they would kind of bring you these dynamic trackable sets to your volume, your LED volume that we're calling it. And that was basically how you were, that's how you were shooting. Am I getting that right?
That's right. And we did a very large portion of the film, of the project, inside this LED volume.
So when you're monitoring this, does it look the way that, you know, we see it when we watch it on our own TVs?
Pretty much.
That's amazing.
Pretty much. Because we're shooting on the Alexa LFs, we're shooting digitally, so we can see what we're getting. And so the point is that you want to get the finished quality of, we didn't really feel like, although we did do a DI, we did do dailies, obviously, where the dailies grade and then a DI. Still the goal is whenever you're shooting on set that you get as close to what your final release image would be on set. Mm.
Back in 2014, we had Tim Weber, who was the visual effects supervisor for Gravity, on the show. And he was talking about, I guess a lot of the scenes were shot similarly with the LED panels, but they weren't using the LED panels for finished look. They were still being replaced in post. They were using it so that the light sources were realistic and it wasn't filled with green bleed.
Exactly. So yeah, that was obviously one of our goals, was that to create an environment that was lit correctly by the LED panels. Especially with color science applied by the color science engineers at ILM, because the difference between something that emits yellow and something that then records yellow needs to be computed so that the appropriate yellow might be put through the emitter of the LED so that the camera actually sees the correct yellow, let's say, as an example. But yeah, as a 3D lighting environment, that was one of the goals. Greg built a large volume space for Rogue One that was ostensibly just a lighting environment. But when we were working with John Knoll from ILM, it was so dramatic, so fantastic, the quality of the images that they provided of the animation for the escape from Jeddah or some of the other cockpit work when they were flying, either flying into Edu or certainly escaping from Jeddah, or when they're flying above Scarif and the X-Wing pilots are flying in through the force field gate and down into Scarif. The image was so fantastic that we were really disappointed that we couldn't photograph the wall at all, because the pixels that we had, the technology for the pixels then was 9 millimeters between each pixel. So it was very big. So we explored many ways of trying to defeat that by hanging industrial size widths of shower curtain. We'd experimented with different thicknesses of shower curtain just to ever so slightly diffuse the image to defeat the pixel dimension, but couldn't really do it. So everything was basically, whenever we saw off the foreground characters in Rogue One and we saw the background of whatever environment they were flying in, although the foreground characters were lit perfectly right, they would replace the background, essentially just matching what was on the screens that we were photographing, but with a higher quality image. So what we do now is we're 2.8 millimeter pixels on the Mandalorian. So
you're talking about the pixels in the screens, the LED screens.
Exactly. So the pixels are much closer together. So with a combination of not focusing on the screen and the right sort of lenses, we can shoot in this environment and shoot the screens and not have them replaced later. They actually are in camera finals.
How big are these rooms?
It's around about, well, we did a test in June to make sure the technology would work, and that was about a 30-foot diameter, 35-foot diameter volume. This volume is 75-foot in diameter and about 20 feet high. Season two, we have a slightly larger one.
How did you feel? I mean, that it's a good space, but it can be cramped at times with everybody on the frame and, you know, your whole crew there and everything. I mean, did it feel cramped at all to you?
There are challenges in regards blocking to work out how you can fit in what you need to fit into the space.
Yeah.
So you have to make a value judgment early on about the size of the space and how you're going to use it, and what is it really worth the cost, the time and money to build the virtual sets to shoot on there? Because if it's not a big enough space, then you're wasting your time. So we spend a lot of time in pre-production in VR, where we build all of these sets in VR. And then we scout them. So, you know, upwards of five or six people, director, producers, DP, production designer, VFX, we can scout together in these environments, and we can put up lenses and work out. It's all the same technology that Jon Favreau and Caleb Deschanel worked out with Lion King. I listened to your interview with Caleb about Lion King.
And, thanks. Yeah.
I wish I could sound as astute as him, but Caleb's a genius. So we do a lot of scouting in VR, and therefore we can work out the size of the sets and the size of the volume and how things work. But we can do a lot of lensing in that environment. We can work out how far away the lenses can be or need to be. Will they fit? Will the shots that we want to execute, will they fit inside the volume? And so it's sometimes the payoff from shooting inside the volume, because it means that you can build a very small set, but by having digital set extension that's done in pre-production, you can then photograph that, you can frame for that. If there's this huge building or mountain or a horizon line, or there's a waterfall or a cliff, if you're shooting in a green screen environment, and you don't have simulcam, you don't know how to frame for that. So you end up with these very sterile images that don't necessarily pay attention to what is truly happening in the background. Whereas we have this live 3D photoreal background that we can frame for. So we maybe just raise the camera up a few inches. Now we can see the horizon line of the valley disappearing in the distance, which immediately makes the shot more appealing or conducive or certainly even part of the storytelling.
So I've got a question. You're using these digital sets on LED panels. Do you get them? Like, are they completely in focus? And then do you make adjustments to them as you're shooting? So like, if you want the look of an 85, but you don't have the distance, perhaps, are you able to make adjustments to the LED screens at the moment to adjust for the depth in the frame?
There's a few things to unpack in that question. So when you're shooting a scene, there will be, most of the photographic coverage will focus on the people that are in the foreground in the scene. So whatever's in the background will be inherently out of focus. So we have the ability to adjust the amount of out of focusness on the screen. But we use these lenses from Panavision that Dan Sasaki made custom for us. They're a 1.65 squeeze anamorphic lens that uses the whole sensor on the Alexa LF that gives us a native 239. So we have a very lovely widescreen, filmic widescreen feel or look, which was one of the original designs and goals to a Star Wars TV show, needed to feel like a Star Wars movie. And yeah. So we wanted to shoot 239. So with these anamorphic lenses, we do get focus drop-off that's appealing and satisfactory and very filmic, and also doesn't show the technical difficulties of photographing a pixel screen that might moire. Now, we actually don't have – we were surprised. We thought moire was going to be a problem, but it was much less of a problem than we realized. Occasionally when you are shooting a scene, though, if somebody stands there and points off to the town in the distance and says, I'm going there or something like that, you probably would focus to the town so that you could see what was going on. So we had a few little photographic tricks that we did. We either would focus nearly to the wall, nearly to the screen, but generally if the screens had to be in focus, then they would probably be replaced later. So then we would just put a specific green screen on the LED volume in the area that we wanted to be, whether it was the whole frame or part of the frame that we wanted to drop in a photoreal image later that was not in any way compromised with pixels.
I have to find a way to get on one of these sets so I can see how this thing works, because more and more people are talking about it now, and it just seems fascinating to me. There is so much more to talk about with Baz Idowin, but before we get there, I want to talk about PostLab. Now, I have been a huge Final Cut Pro 10 advocate for many, many years, as I'm sure a lot of you guys know. I converted my entire studio over to Final Cut within the first 3 months of release. Yes, I was that person that jumped right in head first, and I absolutely love Final Cut. But PostLab is the next big evolution and revolution for Final Cut, because it is a collaboration tool that enables users to share libraries, track and save changes, and they make sure that no more than one person is working on a library at the same time, which is huge. That means you get zero conflicts plus a recallable history of your project. Now, this is what Final Cut Pro 10 users have been waiting for. Yes, there were ways to share libraries before PostLab, but PostLab takes it to a whole different level. This is a must-have app for Final Cut Pro users. Now, the best part is that PostLab runs on a cloud that is purposely built for Final Cut Pro 10 libraries, making sure that they do not break, which can happen if you use libraries on a run-of-the-mill cloud service. You know you've all tried it, and you know it has not been successful all the time. That is not the case when you're using PostLab. You're working on a cloud that's made for Final Cut Pro 10 libraries. Your libraries will not break. It is rock solid. Plus, the collaboration tools are amazing. It's great. Within a production, collaborators can set up and assign tasks, comment on changes, and set statuses on the libraries. There's so much there packed in to PostLab. It's a must-have for Final Cut Pro users. And here's the cool thing. You're going to get 3 months free by going to gocreativeshow.com/PostLab. 3 months free. Why wouldn't you give this thing a shot? So all of my Final Cut Pro 10 people, my brothers and sisters in the world of Final Cut Pro 10, join me in using PostLab. You get 3 months free at gocreativeshow.com/PostLab. I'm going to let you in on a little secret. When big, huge production companies come to Boston to film their commercials or their movies, they are using Rule Boston Camera for their rental equipment. They are. I use Rule. Everybody uses Rule because it's the best. They have a gigantic inventory. They have incredible customer support. They're going to make sure that you completely understand how to use the equipment before you take it out for a rental, and they are committed to supporting you the entire time you have the equipment. Now, they don't mess around, those guys. They've been in business for nearly 40 years. They are known throughout the industry as a leader, especially in the New England area. And that's why I absolutely love those guys. They are committed to you, and they're committed to your production. You really have a production partner when you're working with Rule. So visit their website at rule.com, R-U-L-E.com, and check out their inventory. There's a whole section there called Learn, where you can get access to a bunch of videos of them doing some training seminars. It is just chock full of information for you. But the thing you want to know is that they're reliable, they got a huge inventory, and they are supporting you. And that's what Rule is all about, right? RULE.com. Check them out for yourself and experience the Rule way. I've been hearing a lot about the use of digital Sputniks in the show, and I don't know whether it's true or not. I haven't been able to find out for sure, but I've been hearing about it. I want to start there and sort of broaden out to just your overall lighting philosophy for The Mandalorian. So let's start with digital Sputniks. Is the rumor true? Are you guys using those lights?
Oh, yes, very much so. Greg and I have used them a lot for many years, and we had a lot on Mandalorian. We had a lot on Rogue One as well, I think, but we had a lot on Mandalorian.
What do you love about them?
Well, they have a good quality of hardness. They have a, from a DP's point of view, they're very easy to use, and you can stack them up in great quantities. They're very versatile. They're very small, and you can put them all over the place. Mm. So Season 2, we're not using exclusively digital Sputniks. We've got a much wider range of lights that we're using. But in Season 1, we had roughly 800 modules, meaning all sorts of different heads, DS1s, DS3s, DS6s, beams. And then we made a device called a Beast that had 40 modules all stacked together.
So
that
was, my God.
It was one of our big hard lights. So basically, we did the whole show with them. A few HMIs every now and then, but the first season was mostly done with DSs.
I love that. Now, on Instagram, Svea Van Kahn is asking about a DMX technician. They said that they noticed in the credits there was a DMX technician and wanted to know if you're using DMX and wanted to know how you're using DMX on the show.
Every set. We is basically run through a board. It's one of the joys of shooting with LED is that you can play with color and density, obviously not to an infinite degree, but to an extreme degree, so that by running everything through a DMX board, you can control everything so quickly, so rapidly. I heard Tim Ives talking on your show about the mall, and that's the perfect example of a large set. When we had the prison ship on episode 6, I think we had like 600 lights in that set that were all controlled in a board. The visual representation of what the board was doing for that scene was extraordinary, but we could control the level of intensity of any unit that we wanted, just myself and the gaffer, Jeff Webster, and Derek, who's his board op. We had the ability to very quickly change the lighting per shot or even between takes in a shot to find the perfect ratio and balance of what we wanted. There was a lot of complicated, unusual lights in that sequence. I don't know if you remember, it went flashing white and then it went red. And yeah, it was quite a, that was a very fun set to shoot in.
Which set are you, which scene are you talking about?
The prison ship. In
episode six. Yeah. It must've been fun working with Bill Burr too. He's a Boston guy. So when I knew that episode was coming up, I'm like, you know, I gotta be in it for episode six. I gotta support my city here.
Yeah, he's pretty funny.
Yeah, I love that episode. And I know exactly what you're talking about. And first of all, you're plugging my show better than I am, now bringing up two previous episodes on this show. Are you just being nice or are you a fan of Go Creative Show? I love this.
I like the people that you talk to. You know, so there's definitely... No, I'm a fan of the show, of course.
I love that. Oh, man. All right, so, you know, and it's weird. It's like, people talk a lot about the way that, you know, people talk about the changes in cinematography, filmmaking over the past decade. And they talk about cameras and they talk about, you know, HD, 4K, 8K, blah, blah, blah. But really what I've seen is that there's been probably even more significant changes in lighting, in the way that we're using them. I mean, it's not just tungsten versus LED anymore. Now, there's a lot of programmed lights, and there's a lot of, like we're talking about now, DMX technicians and working. I mean, it's amazing how different the lighting techniques on film and TV shows has been in the past 10 years. It's crazy. I mean, you must have seen it yourself, of course.
Yes, I've been around for a long time. So I remember when one of the first video taps was put onto a film camera. So seeing video taps come on set obviously changed a lot of things. I shot film for a very long time after the introduction of digital, just because of the DP that I was pulling focus for. Robert Ellsworth was loved film. So, and we worked on projects, phenomenal projects, that we shot everything on film. So the transition from film to digital has been very interesting, and I think very enjoyable. I think both are very valid tools, and depending upon the story, you know, you can make a decision as to which one of those two tools, film versus digital, you want to use. Lighting, I think LED lighting is one of the exciting things, because the ability to change so much on the fly through a DMX board, the quality of light is, you know, it's still getting there. There's a lot of things that some of those big old 5, 10, 20K tungstens or HMIs with those big, huge elements, the Fresnels at the front. I'd like to see a time when we get into those, when LEDs become big enough that we can actually get some sort of light like that. Yeah, but the lighting changes of the lighting world, or the lighting available at lighting tools in the last even 6 years, I'd say, are phenomenal.
Can you talk a little bit broader about just your general approach to lighting in the Mandalorian? Because, you know, a show like Star Wars, the science fiction aspect of it is sort of uniquely tailored to that kind of LED lighting. I think like you can be a little harsher in your lighting for science fiction than you may for just like, you know, a straight up modern day drama. But talk to me a little bit more about the way that you approached lighting in general for The Mandalorian and where the inspiration came from.
Well, Gil Taylor, who lit, was the DP on A New Hope, the first Star Wars movie, was one of our inspirations. But to some extent, and these were conversations with Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni and Greg and myself early on, is that it was very important that we satisfied the Star Wars is so important that for it to feel like it fits in, you have to that it feels like part of the general narrative, the way you have to shoot it has to make sense, or has to match, not so much match is the wrong word, but it has to fit in with the ethic of those first few films. But more interestingly, so it's our memory of how those shows looked, as perhaps more so than how they actually looked. And that's exactly what Greg and I were talking about when we were shooting Rogue One, is that if you go back and look at A New Hope, a lot of the lighting looks very hard and a little hokey and not very well shaped and not necessarily very well placed. But your memory of it is so wonderful and strong. So, and that's what we tried to do with Rogue One. So the same thing was with Mandalorian. There's a sense of alternate reality to some extent, it's not absolutely based upon the human experience on Earth, but on the other hand, they're all based upon locations that were shot for the original Star Wars. So it's naturalistic to some extent, but it's definitely not very heavy sci-fi like Alien, let's say.
Yeah. That's, I think, what makes it so interesting, is that blend of even though these are clearly not natural locations, there's a natural sense to it at times, especially in a lot of those golden hour scenes. And there's quite a few of them. And actually, one of our questions on Facebook, Eduardo Arez Soares is asking, he wants to know more about the Golden Hour scenes. He's complimenting on how gorgeous it looks, and I agree, and how you achieve them. Was that also these LED panels you were talking about?
Yes, most of those Magic Hour scenes were shot inside the volume, and that's one of the benefits of the volume, the LED volume, is that we have the time in pre-production to map out what the shots are and the angles, and so therefore where the sun will be and how bright the sun will be and what level of atmospheric haze there will be. So when I said that we could be in Iceland in the morning and Hawaii in the afternoon, travel costs are cut down, but also the ability to shoot a full day of shooting at magic hour is not something that you can do in the real world. On a great film that I worked on, Michael Clayton, we had a sequence with George Clooney getting out of his car, being despondent, getting out of his car in the middle of the countryside at dawn, in that very low light before the sun has come up, and seeing a horse up or a group of horses up on a hill. And he went up to the horses to relate to them, luckily, because his car blew up. Sorry if I gave away. Spoiler alert.
Spoiler.
But we shot that over 5 dawns and 4 dusks in upstate New York. And it was very complicated, very difficult, maybe 1 or 2 shots per time event, dawn or dusk. And beautifully executed. Robert Ellsworth's a master, and Tony Gilroy, the director, is also a phenomenal director and appreciator of light and performance, and I think that's a great sequence. So very, very difficult to do and expensive, whereas we can create a dawn or a dusk or a moment of low light in the middle of a storm or something like that, that will extend all day. So we can shoot for it all day. We can go and have lunch. We can come back and the lighting condition is the same. So it's quite an extraordinary tool for us to have, to be able to create these beautiful lighting environments.
We had Faden Papamichael on talking about Ford versus Ferrari. And I don't know if you saw that film, but they do a lot of like magic hour shots. And
I had not seen it yet.
It's crazy. It's like it was all naturally done. So they only had like half an hour to shoot something. And they would prep all day and shoot it just at that moment. It's crazy.
It's traditionally how we used to do it. And, you know, I spent many years doing it, where you go to a location and you in the morning, you shoot stuff that's light appropriate. As Caleb was saying, same thing about Lion King. And then at lunchtime, you try and shoot stuff that doesn't really, you know, matter, that, or you have to silk the sky because the light above is particularly harsh, and then you save some of that beautiful work that you want to do at the end of the day.
A bunch of people wanted to know about how you dealt with the reflectiveness of the Mandalorian's armor.
Oh, yeah. It was not easy. Having the 3D lighting environment inside the LED volume, obviously that was one of a strong selling point for using it, because he's just a mirror ball, and reflecting all of that light was, you know, incredibly challenging. So there was a strong desire for every shot for there not to be any VFX fixes to remove bad things reflected in his helmet. And I think most of the time we didn't need to do any of those VFX fixes. There were a few that probably needed to be done where something was reflected in him. But most of the lighting that we used in the environment was such that we tried to make the reflections usable in Mando, as well as the human faces or the creature faces next to Mando look okay.
Did you have to worry about that with those LED screens? Were they causing a problem for you?
No, they were solving a problem.
Really?
Yeah, because it created a lighting environment that was actually accurate and representative of what was supposed to be going on, of what was a real lighting environment. So then if I needed to add lighting elements to light faces or people beside Mando, that would be then when you might need to fix reflections.
There's a lot of talk about the Mandalorian being reminiscent of Westerns. I want to get your thoughts on that. Were you inspired by them? And was there anything that you did in the cinematography or the lens choices that helped support that?
The lens choices were, you know, obviously what I said was earlier is that we selected these lenses, these 1.65 anamorphic lenses, 1.65 squeeze, that's in difference to 2x squeeze, which is the traditional anamorphic squeeze lenses that gives you a widescreen image. And so the anamorphic gives you a slightly Western feel, but framing definitely was something that we did. We wanted to – how can I backtrack? Jon Favreau and Dave Filoni very much wanted the show to feel like The Mandalorian was a gunslinger, a roaming gunslinger through the Western type landscape of the galaxy. And so Western tropes were themes that we leaned on heavily for most episodes.
Were you inspired by any specific films? Like, did anything, you know, did you watch, knowing that you wanted this to be kind of a Western world, did you go back and watch any old spaghetti Westerns or anything like that?
All of them. We have in my office, at the production, I have a huge library of films that we're constantly referencing, from Sergio Leone to John Ford to even slightly more modern Westerns. So that, you know, we keep that that feeling. But it was really the films that inspired George Lucas to, from the 50s and 60s, for him to make his film in the 70s, were, that's where we went back mainly to those films for inspiration.
You are listening to the PremiumBeat.com Song of the Week. This one's called Endgame by Arteria Productions. PremiumBeat.com is where to go for all of your royalty-free music. Check out PremiumBeat.com and access a collection of thousands of royalty-free tracks for as low as $49 each. And most of the time, you don't just get the individual track, you get cutdowns and loop sets and stems. Really what that means is you have the ability to customize the track to fit your project perfectly. Now, here's a little inside tip. When you go to premiumbeat.com, scroll down to the bottom and learn those key commands. They're not hard. It'll only take you a couple minutes, but it's going to make your browsing game so fast. You're going to absolutely love those key commands over at premiumbeat.com. So there you go. Fantastic music, super low price, great navigation. It is everything you want in a royalty-free music hub. PremiumBeat.com. Now, there is so much more to learn from Baz Idowin, but before we get there, I want to quickly talk about Shutterstock. Shutterstock.com is, of course, where you go, where I go, where we all go for royalty-free images and videos and music. But I want to draw your attention to Shutterstock Select, which is the upper echelon of what Shutterstock has to offer. We're talking about thousands of cinema-quality clips created by industry pros on cutting-edge gear. I'm talking RED cameras, Zeiss Master Prime lenses, and more. And they got great prices. All the Shutterstock Select clips are $3.99, and that includes unlimited worldwide usage. So this is something to absolutely check out. They're already put in fantastic, easy categories, but the footage looks so good. It is so good. Shutterstock Select is the best of the best when it comes to royalty-free video. So check it out for yourself at Shutterstock.com. Hover over footage and scroll down to Shutterstock Select. You will love it. Now we have to talk about Baby Yoda. This has taken over the world. Baby Yoda has taken over the world. It's incredible. Did you know that it was going to be as big of a phenomenon as it is?
I think most of us on set knew that it was going to be well received. We didn't think that it would be changing or so incredible, so life changing. He's a little cute guy, that's for sure. We've all been in love with him for about a year and a half. So I'm really happy that the world's now experiencing him. I don't think any of us knew that he was going to become as popular as what he is.
It really is incredible. He's so damn cute. You can't help yourself. As I was watching it, I'm like, oh my God. Like, it starts off and it's really cool, you know, Baby Yoda, just the it's just an interesting thing in this world that you've created here. But then you just can't help but love that stupid thing. It's crazy. Truett Morrow on Facebook wants to know how much of Baby Yoda was CGI versus puppets. And it seems to me that most of it was puppets.
That is true. Most of it is puppets. There is a couple of CGI moments where a puppet can't accurately climb up a chair or walk down a ramp. But we did have multiple puppets for either walking or sitting or emoting. The little guy's fantastic. We all loved him.
Now, talk to me about the way that you worked with the puppeteers in working with the Baby Yoda scenes.
It's really a combination of working out exactly where is the best position for the puppeteers to be to get the best performance out of the puppet, and then how much occlusion of the puppet is there from the camera from them to the camera, or occlusion of all of the lighting setup that I've got by the puppeteers. And then what compromises or what changes you can make to the lighting setups so that you accommodate where the puppeteers are. And obviously, if you're shooting a scene with puppeteers, you shoot a clean plate and then you shoot the scene with the puppet and the puppeteers. And so you just have to make sure that the lighting on the child is not compromised by where the puppeteers want to be.
So these are puppeteers manipulating Baby Yoda, like, on set, in frame, or are they doing it, you know, remotely from somewhere offset?
Both. There's occasionally there it would be a fully animatronic puppet that is either probably just sitting there or standing somewhere, and they're totally using the animatronic controls, wireless controls. But if they needed to do some other work, if it needed to move slightly or if its hands needed to move, then there would be a puppeteer on set. Or there might be a puppeteer underneath it, maybe moving it, assisting it and turning it and stuff. So there was a good mix of completely animatronic and a puppeteer on set in camera.
I can imagine that becomes a challenge with blocking sometimes, lighting sometimes. There must have been points where you sort of thought to yourself, like, can we just do this offset so you don't have to be on set right now? I mean, was there ever any conflict between you, the puppeteers, the talent? Did it ever get annoying?
Well, obviously, there are often moments where things are challenging, but you don't make them annoyances. You make them challenges to rise above. The day is a constant parade of difficulties that you need to overcome, and I think if you get annoyed, then you're not doing your job right, or you're not going to get through the day very well.
That's true.
Yeah, there are times the cockpit was very small, there's lots of scenes inside the Razor Crest cockpit, and the baby's in a lot of them.
Yeah.
So, yeah, it's complicated. It's difficult, but there are challenges to rise to and above.
In our last couple of minutes, I want to talk about your personal, feelings towards different scenes in the Mandalorian. So, is there a scene that you can point us to that maybe was extraordinarily challenging or rewarding? Something that you want to call out as, you know, maybe a great achievement for you on the series?
Well, there's such a combination of there's individual shots that I remember that I just love, that are spectacular. Like in episode 2, when he's outside the Mudhorn cave and he's just getting ready for battle. Or there was a particular moment when he is outside the Mudhorn and he is defeated. His weaponry is all broken or spent. He's got nothing. The Mudhorn's about to charge him, and all he can do is very, very limply lift up his vibroblade, his knife, because that's the only defense or the only thing that he can do. And as the Mud Horde charges him, and then it stops because the child lifts him. That was a really lovely sequence to shoot because there was some beautiful photographic moments in that that I really enjoyed doing. It was really great. But I have to say, it's very hard to pick out special moments because there's so much of it. Every episode's got something spectacular and enjoyable. I really love characters. I really love working what I really love doing is telling a story. So there were moments in episode 6 where we were getting deep into character, into study and exploration that I really enjoyed. So I think that's probably photographically, yes, I love some of those things are fantastic, but actually being able to tell the story is perhaps more enjoyable at the end of the day.
We got a couple of post questions if you have the time. Diego Fabricio Diaz Palomo on Facebook wants to know, what were the challenges for the visual effects artists that the show was shot on anamorphic glass? So does shooting anamorphic make it more challenging for VFX? Do you know?
Yes. Mm. Yes.
What are the challenges?
There's inherent imperfections in the way that the glass transmits light. So there are chromatic aberrations and density adjustments, and the lenses have a lot of character and are very, very imperfect, which is one of the joys and beauties of them. So that makes it more difficult for the VFX houses. But on the other hand, they map them very extensively to understand all of those characteristics. So then they just have to apply that to the work later. I think that films, VFX houses have been doing work on anamorphic shot films for a very long time. So it's not necessarily surprising, but yes, it is a little bit more challenging.
And Jamie Dickinson on Twitter wants to know, he says, we have to know about the HDR-ness of it. So I guess HDR is still relatively new. You know, a lot of streaming networks are starting to implement it, but it's certainly not widespread as much as it may be in the next few years or so. Can you just give us a little bit of insight from your opinion, what the difference of the two is? And does that affect the way that you film in light?
We knew we were going to do an HDR release. So we knew that we couldn't put white paper on windows and blow out the windows because in HDR you see detail out there now. We did extensive testing with the HDR for the DI to see where we wanted to go, what we wanted it to look like. And we did do two different releases through two different grades through for Disney Plus, SDR and HDR. So the primary difference between HDR and SDR is that you've got blacker blacks and brighter whites. So I don't know what the top nit level is on SDR, if it's 100, but you're not always up there. You're only up there for some of the bright stuff. But we had a much higher nit level maximum for the HDR, and so certainly some scenes are brighter. The sun is brighter. When we see the sun in shot, it looks brighter. When you see a hot sky, it looks brighter. There's a little bit of color difference sometimes that happens, but nothing that's unmanageable. Certainly seeing bright windows. If before on an SDR image, maybe you had a bright white hot window. When you're shooting an interior scene in HDR, you might see detail outside that window. So then you have to be careful about what you see outside that window.
Are you monitoring for both on set?
Not continuously. Occasionally, if I suspected something might pose an HDR challenge later.
Well, I can't thank you enough for being on Go Creative Show and sharing your experience shooting The Mandalorian. I mean, come on, that is such a it's a huge show. Clearly, the biggest on Disney Plus. Really, the biggest show that anyone's been talking about since its release. It is a massive success. And I mean, wow, it must feel good to be in your position right now, knowing there's a season 2 coming out and having a hit on your hands.
Thank you very much. Yes, it's unusual I haven't done a lot of TV. So normally in all of the feature films that I've done, when they are released, I'm working on something else or I'm in a different country working on a different project. So now that I'm working on season 2 while season 1 of Mandalorian is coming out, it's been a very enjoyable experience.
Well, invite me to set. I want to see how these LED panels work. I would love to give Go Creative Show the scoop and the behind the scenes for season two. We'd love that.
Oh, very good. I can tell you that there'll be two extensive articles on in the ASC magazine and the ICG magazine coming out in February.
Oh, nice. That's awesome. Baz Idowin, you can find him on Instagram, right? You have an Instagram?
I do.
Awesome. And what's the handle on Instagram? Is it just your name?
Yes, it is. Just Baz Idowin.
All right. BAZIDOINE. And of course, your website as well. I'll put all of that in the show notes so you guys can check it out. But The Mandalorian, out right now, the entire season on Disney Plus. Baz, thank you so much for being on Go Creative Show.
That's a pleasure, Ben. Thank you very much.
Now, that was a fun one. What a great interview. I want to thank Baz Idowin for coming on to talk about his work on The Mandalorian and so much more. And you can find him at his Instagram and his website, which we will put links to in the show notes, so check it out there. And I want to thank you guys. I mean, many of your questions were in this episode. In fact, I think that your questions made this episode so good. So I want to keep that up. Follow us on social media. We will let you know when we have upcoming guests, and you guys get an opportunity to have your questions heard on the show. Of course, I want to thank our producer, Connor Crosby. You can find him at ignitionvisuals.com. And Matt Russell, who mixes and masters and makes the show sound so good. You can find him at gainstructure.com. And of course, follow me at Ben Consoli and follow the show at Go Creative Show everywhere. Instagram, Facebook, YouTube, Twitter, we're everywhere you need to be. And we'd love to have you subscribe to the show. That way you don't miss an episode. It's important. It's important, people. Subscribe to the show. I also want to thank our sponsors, Rule Boston Camera, Post Lab, Shutterstock, and Premium Beat. Without these people, the show wouldn't exist. So please support those, support us. See you next week. Bye-bye.